This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Shir on Thursday night, when we were discussing the problems that result from the necessity to publish so much Torah as is being published today in English and in a easily digestible form. And one of the points that I made was that the Torah was originally not written down, apart from the Torah Shebichtav. The Torah Shebichtav itself, the written law itself, as we saw at Shalosh Shudos, is not very intelligible without the Torah Shebaal Peh. So we were left with a work of literature that was virtually unintelligible, and the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law which made the Torah Shebichtav intelligible, was only handed down orally. And one of the many reasons for that was so that the principles of Torah shouldn't get into the wrong hands, shouldn't get into the hands of people who don't fully understand them, who don't fully appreciate them, and who don't fully understand how to relate to them. Whereas once one, and then when Torah was written down, Mishnah, Gemara, Rishonim, Shulchan Aruch, Rambam, when these things were finally written down, they were always written down in such a brief and concise form that they're still unintelligible without a Rebbe, without being taught Torah, without being taught how to learn a Mishnah, how to learn a Gemara, how to learn a Rashi. Without actually being taught that, you can't open a Gemara, you don't know how to learn. So again, at least, although it was written down, at least the control was held in the hands of the teacher. That is, a teacher could ensure that he only gave the Torah to people who were capable of understanding it correctly, and B, could ensure that the people who were giving it to did understand it correctly. But once it comes to putting things into print which are intelligible as they stand, which is really, this is the first generation that that's ever happened. Up to now, the only time that happened a little bit was in journals and things. You would pick up an odd magazine and there would be an article or two, but very little was ever written down. For example, you'll find very little in Hashkofa, very little shirim like this Motzei Shabbos shir. They were never written down. They were given in yeshivas and things, and they were never published until very recently. What was published was only halacha, gemoras and halacha and analysis and so on, which you had to be a Talmid Chacham to understand. You couldn't understand it if you weren't a Talmid Chacham. So this is the first generation ever, I think, that Torah is being presented in a printed form intelligible to the masses. And we discussed on Thursday night some of the problems that result from opening the doors of Torah quite that indiscriminately. What emerges from that is the frighteningly large responsibility imposed on a teacher of Torah, and not necessarily only a formal teacher of Torah. Even if you're simply speaking to somebody offhand, or you're standing up at a Sheva Brochus and you're saying a vort, or you're suddenly saying a Devar Torah at your Friday night table, whatever it is, if you're imparting a Torah thought, the horrific responsibility that there is on the individual is imparting that Torah thought. Because if he puts a Torah thought into the hands of somebody who will misunderstand it, or even worse, misuse it, the responsibility is his, and all the damage which is afterwards done with that is really on his shoulders. And unfortunately, all over the world today, we have reform rabbis and conservative rabbis who were taught in yeshivas, some of them, by Frum Rabbein, and they're far more dangerous than the ignorant ones, because they've been taught a little bit and they know a little bit, and the people think they know. And who's really responsible for that? The people who taught them in the first place. And then one becomes overwhelmed in a sense by that sense of responsibility that there is in ensuring that the people to whom one is teaching are people who are qualified to learn. What I've been looking for, and what we're going to determine in this shiur, is what are the qualifications to learn? What must you look for? On what basis do you decide? It can't be that you can teach to knowledgeable people, because how does anybody get their first steps in knowledge? So you must be able to teach a person who knows nothing. So the method of deciding whether a person qualifies to be a Talmid or not cannot be one of knowledge. You can teach people who know nothing, and you can teach Talmidei Chachamim. That's not the criteria, obviously. The criteria must be something else, and we have to find out, both in halacha and in philosophy, what are the things one has to look for? What is it that one must note that one's Talmidim have before one accepts them to be Talmidim at all? In the beginning of the Sedra today, the word Vayar is repeated twice in a way that makes it difficult to understand. The three angels, or as they appear to Avrom, just three ordinary people, appear up the road near to Avrom's home. Vayiso Einov Vayar, and he lifts up his eyes and he sees, and he saw. And behold, there were three people standing close to him. Vayar, and he saw Vayoros Likrosom, and he ran to meet them. What's the second Vayar? It says already he saw that there were three people standing before him. It should then simply continue, and he ran to meet them. Why does it say Vayar, and he saw again Vayoros Likrosom Mipesach Ha'el, and then he ran to meet them from the entrance of his tent? And it's on that difficulty which the Medrash explains the following. Vayar Bashchino, Vayar Bamalochi. He did see twice because he saw two separate things. Vayar, he saw and perceived the Shechino, the Ribbono Shel Olam's presence. Vayar Bamalochim, and he saw and he perceived the Malochim. So although the verb is the same, Vayar and Vayar, the Medrash is telling us that there are two different objects to those two verbs. In the first case, the object is the Shechino, he saw God's presence. In the second case, the object is the Malachim, he saw the angels. What does all this mean? So the Medrash explains. Amar Rabbi Levi, Echod Nidme Loi Bidmus Sarki. One of the men appeared to him, one of the angels appeared to him in the form of a traveler, a salesman. The Echod Bidmus Navti. And one of them appeared in the form of a sailor. The echod bidmus arabi, and one is an Arab. You see that being an Arab is a profession. A salesman and a sailor and an Arab. So these are the three people that he saw. He looked up and he saw three people, a salesman, a sailor and an Arab. Three very different kinds of people. Omar, now he's got a difficulty. You know, Avram's method of education is very interesting to study because there are lots of paradoxes in it. On the one hand, his home has got four doors so that people can come in easily. On the other hand, he's got a tree outside, and the tree is a sort of a test. He can tell by how the tree responds to the person whether he's going to let this person into his house at all or not. So on the one hand, everything looks very open. On the other hand, Avram is very discriminating as to who he allows into his house and who he doesn't. On the one hand, he sees three Arabs up the road, Vayarotzli Krosom, and he runs to meet them. But don't think he didn't do that without testing them first. He says to himself, Avram's not going to go running to meet just any Tom, Dick and Harry. He's got to know who these people are. But that's halacha l'maisa. Now it's no good saying, I'll wait till they come into my house and I'll learn some Gemara with them and I'll see what they're like. That's no good. It's going to be too late. He wants to know whether he should run to meet them or he should wait for them to come to him. That's what he's got to decide already. So he's got to study them. Omar, he said to himself, Im roya ani shishchino mamtenes aleim, ani yodea shehem bnei odom gedoyim. If I look at them carefully, and I see that the Shechino is hovering around, I see that the Ribbono Shel Olam is there. Or another way of translating this, and possibly a more correct way of translating it is, don't forget he was busy talking to the Ribbono Shel Olam at the time that these three people came. He then said to the Ribbono Shel Olam, so to say, hang on a while, I've got some visitors here, I'll see you later. So he said to him, if the Ribbono Shel Olam agrees with that, he said to himself, I'll tell God to wait for me a while. If God accepts that and says, sure, you go and attend to your visitors and I'll speak to you later, then I know they're very great people. That's the first test he was going to perform. And if I see them showing honor to one another, if I see them honoring each other, and yodea shehen b'nei odom muhugonim, I know that they are fine people. Already at this point, the Medrash is extremely surprising. What's his first thing? He says his first test is, I'll check whether God will hang on. If the Ribbono Shel Olam is prepared to wait while I attend to my guests, they must be very great people. Otherwise the Ribbono Shel Olam would say, what a chutzpah, I'm busy talking to you and you're going to look after people. So they must be important people. Yet he still needs a second test to see whether they're fine people. That means it's conceivable to have a person for whom the Ribbono Shel Olam is prepared to wait. Somebody that the Ribbono Shel Olam feels is almost more important than he himself. He's busy talking to Avrom, and somebody comes down the road, and the Ribbono Shel Olam is prepared to allow Avrom to go and attend to the stranger, because the Ribbono Shel Olam thinks it's important enough. And it can be an Adam Godoy, says Avram, that will be a sign that the man is an Odom Gadol, he's a great man. But I still don't know whether he's a fine man or not. I still don't know whether he's an Odom Hogun. And we're going to spend the whole shiur trying to translate the word Hogun. What exactly the word Hogun means. But basically we see that it's possible to be a man considered as Gadol, even somebody who God considers as Gadol, as great, and yet you're not a Ben Odom Mehugun, you're not a fine person. Avraham needs another test to know whether you're a fine human being. What's the second test? To see how they relate to one another. Do they show covet to one another? Do they honor one another? Or don't they? There are different girsas here in the word. So if you come, when you revise the shir, if you look at the midrash, you'll see a slight difference. But if you check down the girsas at the bottom, I'm reading according to one of the girsas, which makes it easiest to understand. It's the girsa of the Matnas Kuhuna. The kivan shiro oison chokin kovod elu leelu. And once he saw them honoring one another, ushchino mantenes lohem, and he saw the Ribbono Shel Olam was prepared to wait for them, yodo shehen b'nei Odom mehugonim. He knew that they were fine people. We have a further proof for the point we've just made. What does it say? And when he saw both tests were fulfilled positively, the Ribbono Shel Olam was prepared to wait for them, and they showed honor to one another, that's a sign that should say that they're b'nei Odom gedolim, that they're great human beings. That would include that they're fine human beings. No. That was a sign that they're fine human beings, and that's all he really has to know. If they're fine human beings, they're certainly great human beings. So when he saw that the Ribbono Shel Olam was prepared to wait, and they were chole kovet to one another, he knew for sure that they were fine human beings. They were Odom, they were b'nei Odom muhugonim. And then he was prepared to run forward to meet them. That means that if he saw that the Ribbono Shel Olam was waiting, he's busy talking to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and he says, excuse me, Ribbono Shel Olam, there's some Arabs coming down the road, I would like to bring them into my home. And the Ribbono Shel Olam says, sure, go right ahead, I'll wait for you. That's a sign that they're b'nei Odom gedolim, that they're great human beings. But still, Avram wouldn't go running out to meet them. That doesn't qualify for Avram to go running out to meet them. But if he sees that in addition to that, they show honor to one another, then it's a reason to go out and meet them. Then Avram, this old, old man, who's just had an operation, and it's 3 days after his operation, and he's in pain and suffering, on a boiling hot day, a miraculously boiling hot day. There's never been a boiling hot day like that at that time of the year before. On such a day, for such people, they're not Jewish, they're Arabs, sailors, travelers, foreigners, but they're showing honor to one another. Avraham Avinu is going to go out of his door, and he's not going to walk up to them. And he's not going to wait for them to come to him. Vayorot is going to run with all the effort and energy he's got to go and meet them and to usher them into his home. That's how Avraham used to bring certain guests into his home. But what was the qualification as to which guests he would bring into his home? Not how much they knew that he wasn't looking at. Not how frum they were that he wasn't looking at. Not whether they were Jewish or non-Jewish. That also wasn't important. What's important is, are they b'nei Odom gedolim? And still more important, are they chole kovod ze leze? Do they honor one another? If they honor one another, Avraham Avinu will run forward to meet them. If they don't, he'll wait until they come, and then we'll see in a little while what he would do if they don't honor one another. We've got to try and determine what this word mehugoni means. What does it mean? We find the word again in a strange Gemara. In Chulin, Daf Kuf Lamed Gimel, Amud Aleph, 133a. Omar Rabbi Zeira Omar Rab, said Rabbi Zeira in the name of Rab, Kol Hashoyne Le Talmid She'enoi Hogun. Anybody who teaches Torah to a Talmid who is not fine, for the moment I'm translating Hogun as fine. We'll translate it accurately still in a little while. So anybody who teaches a Torah to a Talmid who is not Hogun, Kazoirek even le Markulis. It's like throwing a stone at the Markulis. Now the Markulis is a fantastic character of Avodah Zorah. He's an idol. But he's a very interesting idol. All he is three stones. Two stones with one on top. That's a Markulis. And the way of serving him is to add stones to the heap. That's all, people threw stones onto the heap and the heap built up. That was the way of serving that particular idol. It was a form of idolatry, the nature of which we will soon understand. But for one reason or another, the Gemara chooses that image, to convey the concept of what it is, to teach Torah to a Talmud who is not Hogan, to teach Torah to a Talmud who is not fine. Whatever, we're going to have to define this word Hogan, because it now becomes an important halacha. One, not only is one not permitted to teach Torah to somebody who does not fit this qualification of Hogan, but if one does, it's like serving idolatry. It's like throwing a stone at a Markulis. That's the situation. And it's in fact a halacha in Shulchan Aruch. In Yoredei Siman Reish Mem Vav 246, which is Hilchos Talmud Torah, we're not given many guidelines as to who one can teach Torah to and who one can't. But one of the guidelines we're given is the following: Ein melamdin Torah the Talmud she'eino hogun. You can't teach Torah to a Talmud who's not hogun. Elo machzirin oisa elo muta, but you must return him to good. Umanhigim oisa bederech yeshoro, and you must lead him along a straight line. Uvodkin oisa, and you must check that he's in fact sticking to it. Vachakach machlisin oisa lebeis hamedrash, umalamdin oisa, and afterwards you can bring him into the beis hamedrash and you can teach him. This is basically taken from the Rambam, so let's look at the Rambam and try and figure out what hogun means. Because now it's a halacha in Shulchan Aruch. You're only allowed to teach certain people Torah, and the main qualification is hogun, that a person must be hogun, but we don't know what hogun means. And it means different things in different places. And the Rambam adds in a couple of little tiny words here and there, which the Shulchan Aruch for some reason omits. And those words give us a bit of insight as to what the Talmud Hogun is. Says the Rambam in the beginning of the fourth chapter of Hilchos Talmud Torah, Ein melamdin Torah elo le Talmud Hogun, same words, you are not permitted to teach Torah to anybody but a Talmud Hogun, somebody who's fine. Na'er b'masav. Rambam doesn't say ven na'er b'masav, that he must be Hogun and Noe B'Masov, which would intimate that there are two different qualities needed. But he says, Hogun, Noe B'Masov. That means the Rambam is explaining what Hogun means. He must be a Talmud Hogun, that is, Noe B'Masov. His actions must be pleasant. Oy L'Tam, or to somebody that's neither here nor there. You can teach Torah to somebody who's wishy-washy, but to somebody whose actions are not pleasant, you can't teach Torah. But if he was going along a path which is no good, you must return him to good, and you lead him along a straight path, and you examine him, and afterwards you bring him into the Beis HaMedrash and you start teaching him. So the first clue we have as to what Hogun means is from the words Noeh B'Masov. His actions are pleasing, his actions are pleasant. It doesn't help us terribly much, because how do you define pleasant actions? But look a little bit further. If he was going in a way which is not good, doesn't say he was doing avedas, doesn't say he was doing wrong things or anything, he's going, his general approach is not good, then you return him to good and you lead him along Derech Yeshara, along the straight line, which seems to imply that he's left the straight derech, the straight approach. So now we've got to find out what the Rambam defines as the derech tova and the derech yeshora. A little bit earlier in Hilchos Deos, let me just find it. In Hilchos Deos, Perek Vov Halacha Zayin, chapter 6, Halacha 7, says the Rambam, Haroye Chavero Shechoto, if you see that your friend has sinned, Oy Shehonach Bederech Loi Toivo, he's gone along a way which is not good, Mitzvah Lahachziro Lemutav, it's a mitzvah to try and bring him back to the straight and narrow, to the straight, right, to a good way. So we see from the Rambam again that there's one concept of chota, of sinning, doing something wrong, and then there's sheholach bederech lo tova, going along a way which is not good, right, which is different from chote. That means his general demeanor is not good. His general behavior is not good, but not that you can pin anything and say, that's not allowed according to the Torah. And interestingly enough, this halacha is taken from Gemara Brachos Daf Lamed Aleph Amud Beis 31b, where the Gemara says, "Kol haroye dovah she'eino hogun b'chaveroi," the same word. Anybody who sees something which is not hogun has to tell him off. And the Rambam is again translating hogun as derech loy tova, a general approach which is no good. Right? And it's different to chata. You sin, that's one thing. Derech loy tova is something else. And the other place, a little bit earlier again, where we find the Rambam defining what a derech tova of a yeshora is, it's the same thing. A good road and a straight road is the same thing. And we see that it's the same thing from our Rambam, because he says if a man leaves the good road, then you, it's a mitzvah to bring him back to the straight road. So obviously he considers the straight road as being good. In Hilchos Deos, in the beginning, the Rambam lays down his famous thesis of the fact that in any reaction, in any response to a situation, two extremes are possible. You can go to the one extreme or you can go to the other extreme. You can get very angry about something, or you can be unrealistically passive about something. You can be terribly happy about something, or you can be very miserable about something. In every situation, you'll find one's possible emotional responses as covering a wide range of possible emotions from one extreme to another. And the Rambam says the correct way is to go down the middle. One has to contain within one the ability to be very angry and the ability to be very passive, and one has to create a mix with one's mind, using one's mind to figure out what's the correct response. One has to create a mix of both extremes to come out with the correct response to that situation. One must have the capacity for great happiness and the capacity for great sadness. And in any situation, one must be able to mix and blend one's feelings of happiness and sadness to come out with the right blend, which is a middle-of-the-road sort of blend. And this he calls Haderech Hayashova Himido Beino Nishabachol Deo Vedeo. The straight road is the middle road of each attitude. Right? When it's a question of taking an attitude to something, the derech yeshura is to take the full range of possible attitudes and to create a blend which is somewhere in the middle. And further on he says, if I can find it here, that this is derech tova v'yeshura. Not only is it straight, but this is also the good path to follow.
We are commanded to follow these middle paths,
and these are the good and straight paths. So the Rambam here lays his basis. The other Rambams I've brought you all follow on. Here he lays the basis as to what a derech toiva v'yeshora is. A derech toiva v'yeshora is a well-balanced, carefully blended attitude towards all situations. That's what derech yeshora is. And he says, for that you have to be a chacham, for that you have to have wisdom, and you have to be all sorts of things. And then he goes on to say various other things, some of which we'll still come to. Now one begins to understand a little bit about what chogun means. We said, in the Rambam's definition, in Hilchos Talmud Torah, chapter 4, you'll remember, that you can't teach Torah to anybody who is not a Talmud chogun, Noeb b'maso, that means his actions are pleasing. But if he goes b'derek lo tova, what is derek lo tova? That is, his attitudes are extreme, then you should bring him back to the straight path. Manhigi noisei b'derek yeshoro. You guide him straight. You show him how to see things in their correct perspective, how to relate to things and balance them correctly, so as not to find oneself on either of the two extremes. That's the Talmud she'en lo hogun. This ties in very correctly with our whole shiur a couple of weeks ago on yashrus, on what it is to be straight. You remember we developed the idea that yashrus is primarily a concept of lifnim mishuras hadin, doing more than is strictly expected of you, or, as we learned in the case of the Mesilas Yesharim, sometimes doing less than is strictly expected of you. And we gave certain examples, for example, where a man buys a property in between two brothers or partners, strictly speaking, according to the din, he can hang on to the property. But it's a midas chassidus, it's a nice thing to offer it to the other partners, because you're chopping their property in two, and it doesn't matter, you've only got that one property in the middle of nowhere in any case, so you can might as well buy somewhere else. So you lose very little, and the partners on either side of you can gain. Therefore, it's correct to offer them the opportunity to purchase the property. And that, in fact, becomes halacha. You've got to do that. But why do you have to do that? Not because essentially you have to do that, but because of lifnei mishurat hadin, you have to go further than is expected. And that gemara bases itself on the pasuk in the Torah of v'asisa hayoshel v'hatoiv. You must do that which is straight and good. So we learn from there that the basic principle of yashrus, of being straight, is doing more than is required of you. Or, as we said in the case of the Mesilas Yesharim, unless it's mi'ikar hadin, unless it's one of the principles of halacha, sometimes one has to feel that in a given situation it's better not to do. There are times when the halacha would like you to do certain things, but it's not mi'ikore halacha, it's not one of the principles of halacha, then you've got to watch very carefully what the consequence of your action will be. If the consequence will be positive for Torah, then you must do it. But if the consequence will be negative, then it's better that you don't do it. That was the essence of Yashrus, which is Lifnei Mishurat Hadin. And we explained that that sounds a little bit strange, to be able to say that straightness is going further than is required. That sounds wrong. Straightness should surely be when you go by exactly what's required and call Lifnei Mishurat Hadin something else. And we explained now that it doesn't always work like that. That sometimes what appears to be straight isn't really straight because the world isn't straight. We gave the example of what looks like a straight line between New York and London on a map is not a straight line in the real world. It's a curve because the world isn't flat. And so one finds with Torah too, that the Torah is designed for an ideal situation. And that's why we need all the rabbinical laws, all the dinim derabbanan. Because the Torah is designed for ideals. The Torah talks about ideals. To make those ideals work, that you have to be very sensitive and very careful with. You can't just come like a bull in a china shop and start doing what the Torah says or what the Torah appears to say on the surface and expect it all to work in the world and change the world overnight. It doesn't work like that at all. The application of the ideal principles of Torah to the practical realities of the world sometimes need a lot of bending to make them straight. Because although the Torah is straight when we learn it in the Beis HaMedrash, if we'll take the Torah as it stands and apply it as it stands outside the Beis HaMedrash, we'll find the result will be crooked and the result will be distorted. And one has to then straighten it out in accordance with the irregularities of the world and with the imperfections of the practical world outside. That was the concept of Yashrus. And you'll remember we finally came to the Netziv in his introduction to Sefer Bereishis, where he explains why Sefer Bereishis is called Sefer HaYosha, the Book of Straightness, where he came and he said the essence of Yashrus is the ability to tolerate people who disagree with you. That's where you can really see Yashrus. The ability to tolerate even so far as Avraham had to tolerate idol worshippers. Even when you know they're wrong. Most people say, you know, I don't mind, I can tolerate people where I can see that they've got a point. But somebody who I know is totally wrong, there's no way I can tolerate that. But nobody ever acknowledges that the other person has got a point. And in all arguments, people believe that the other person is totally wrong. And therefore, if one's going to make this concept practical, one has to do as the Netziv says and apply it even in the most extreme forms. That the ability, the middah of Yashrus requires that one is able to tolerate even somebody who's doing something totally wrong. Even though you know it's totally wrong, who could have known more clearly than Avraham Avinu that what was going on in Sodom was wrong, that what was going on with Avimelech was wrong, that what was going on with all the other idol worshippers of his time was wrong? Who could have known more than Avraham Avinu and Yitzchak and Yaakov in their time? And the Netziv shows how they cared even for those idol worshippers, how Avraham prayed for the salvation of Sodom. He wanted them improved. He wanted to teach them to change their ways, but to destroy them? That's something that really, really hurt them. To destroy those idol worshippers, as wicked as they were. Avraham fights and fights and fights that Sodom should not be destroyed. Says that the Tziv Yashrus is the ability to let other people live. Just leave other people alone. To be good to them, that's chesed. To care for their needs, that's tzedakah. There are all sorts of other middos and good middos about caring for other people. Yashrus is just leaving them alone. And one has to develop Yashrus before you can develop anything else. If you don't have Yashrus, you can't have chesed. If you don't have Yashrus, you can't have tzedakah. If you don't know how to leave another person alone, then you can't have any of the other positive middos which have to be developed. Don't climb into other people's lives. Don't worry about what they're doing. The first thing is the ability just to let them live. And to want them to live. And to help them to live. They disagree with you, so they disagree. They're wicked and naughty, so they're wicked and naughty. It's none of your business on the level of Yashrus. When you go beyond the level of Yashrus, yes. then you might try and educate them and improve them and so on. But the world is so full of people who are out to educate and missionarize who don't understand the basic principles of yashrus. The first qualification of a missionary must be somebody who's able to let other people live. If you can do that, then we can start moving into other areas of missionary work. But a person who can't tolerate seeing other people doing things with which they disagree, that person is not ready to teach yet, he's not ready to do missionary work, he's not ready to do anything like that at all, because he doesn't have the basic middah of yashrus. And now we know what a Talmid Hogun is. A Talmid Hogun, you remember, we finally defined yashrus as good adjustment, a well-adjusted human being. A human being who can function in the world normally. And while he doesn't adulterate his principles at all, and while he doesn't allow his principles in any way to be diminished, he's able to accommodate others in the application of those principles. The ability to be accommodating, not compromising, chas v'shalom, but accommodating, and the world confuses accommodating and compromising, and the world has tended to put them together, and to accuse anybody who accommodates of being a compromiser, and to look up to anybody who's not accommodating as a man who doesn't compromise his principles. That's wrong. There's such a thing as compromising, that's the dilution of one's principles. But there's something else which is called accommodation. The ability to fit one's principles in to the harsh realities of a world which is far from ideal. Of a world which is far from functioning according to the principles of the Torah, and certainly isn't based on the principles of Torah. And we have to take these principles and somehow make them work in this cockeyed, crazy world in which we live. But that's accommodation, and that's a Talmid Hogun. A Talmid that one can look at and say, this is a man who's well adjusted. I don't know if he's clever or stupid. That's not one of the requirements for teaching. You can teach stupid people as well. I don't know if he is... I don't know anything about him. All I know is that he's hogun, he fits in. And that's really what the word hogun means. He fits. One looks at him and he doesn't look like an oddbod that just doesn't fit in anywhere. He doesn't look maladjusted. He looks like a normal, well-adjusted human being. That much you can judge on first impression. And you need some kind of a method of judging a Talmud on first impression, because your decision is, do I take him into the shir that first time or not? On what basis can one judge that if one doesn't know him yet? So here we're given the one principle which does enable us to judge that. A Talmid Hogun, he must just look normal. He must just look like a well-adjusted human being. He must look like the type of person who, when you teach him a principle, will know how to integrate that principle, understand it, question it if he doesn't understand it, and apply it in a way which will be nice, attractive, and good. That's all. And that makes things a lot clearer to understand. I was with a rabbi overseas on this last visit, and we were sitting in a kosher restaurant, and he said, look at that couple there and look at that couple there and tell me what the difference is. He says, they're both Talmidim of mine, I know them both. So I said, the obvious, I said, I don't know them, how can I tell you what the difference is? He says, look and tell me. So I looked, I said, the only thing I can say is that they both look very similar. The men are both dressed in dark suits, white shirts and black ties, black hats and beards. And the women both dressed the same way, both with tichels on their heads. That's the first observation. Now you want to know what's different. Well, the one couple, the man looks as if the hat and the suit don't belong to him, and the woman looks as if her clothing and her tichel doesn't belong to her, and she looks in fact as if she's never worn it before, and she's just put it on in a rush as she ran out. And the other couple, it looks as if it's his hat and his coat and her tichel and her clothes. That's all I can see. So that's exactly it. So now I'll tell you the story. He said, they've both been involved in Yiddishkeit for 8 years. They both started at the same time. They've both been involved for 8 years. He said, the couple who you said looked as if they've just put on the tichel and the hat and the coat, they just grabbed the nearest one they could find and ran out. They've been wearing a hat and a coat and a tichel and all the rest of it for 8 years. From the day they walked in off the street, they started wearing it. The other couple, what trouble I've had with them. To get them to start keeping Shabbos, it took 2 years. Before they were keeping kashrus, it took 3 years. Before Taras HaMishpocha, it was 5 years. Before I got them to send their children to Jewish schools, it was 7 years. And they just, it's the last 6 months that they look like that. So really, they're the ones who are new to it. And the ones you thought were new to it are the ones who have been doing it for 8 years. And we chatted and we said, well, that's obvious. The ones that Talmid Hogun and the ones that Talmid She'eino Hogun. The one integrates slowly, step by step, does it correctly. When he's satisfied with something, he takes it on, doing it correctly, doing it with feeling, doing it in a nice and pleasant way. It fits. you can see that he's a man who's adjusted. Whatever he does, he's adjusted. If he was wearing the clothing which he was wearing, he looks like a normal human being. If he would be wearing a bathing costume at the sea, he would also look like a normal human being. He fits in. Whatever he's doing, he does correctly. And the other couple just tried to move too quickly. They weren't interested in being well adjusted. They were just interested in doing the right things. I don't understand that doing the right things can be so destructive if one does the right things in a way which is not well adjusted. Let's move back now. So now we understand Avraham Avinu a little bit better. He had to decide whether he's going to run to these people or not. What he had to look for was a sign of their well adjustment. And the most important sign of being well adjusted is how you relate to your society. The only society he could see them relating to was the three of them, to one another. And it was a little society, a sailor and an Arab and a traveller is already a little society. And what he looks for is honour, relating to one another with honour. We'll come to that in a moment. One doesn't teach a Talmud she'ena hogun, and teaching him is kezorek even lemarkulis. It's like throwing a stone at the Markulis. Let's just understand that Gemara first before we go back to Avraham. Every form of Avodah Zorah discussed in the Gemara has a peculiar aspect to it. Each form of Avodah Zorah has its own unique qualities, and it's a separate class of Avodah Zorah. One of the most amazing of all is the Markulis, because it's just a little pile of stones. There's no inherent value in the idol. It doesn't represent anything conceptual. It doesn't represent anything spiritual. It doesn't represent anything figuratively. It doesn't represent anything at all. It's just a pile of stones. And the serving of the idol is not bowing or sacrificing or praying, doing actions which have inherent meaning. No, it's throwing a stone at the thing. There's no inherent meaning whatever in it. Says the Gemara, to teach a Talmud she'eino hogun, it's like doing something which is totally meaningless. What's the purpose of learning Torah after all? It's not just to keep all the Torah inside. Learning Torah is that ultimately, as a result of the learning of the Torah and the way you function inside the world, you'll be able to slowly, slowly help raise the world onto higher standards towards the ideal defined in the Torah. So we've got to take the ideals of Torah and understand them clearly. We have to go outside into the world and accommodate ourselves so as to apply those principles as best we can. We have to engage those principles into the world and slowly edge the world upwards, so that as a result of our relating to the world with these principles, the world in fact benefits. That's ultimately what we're meant to be doing. To take a Talmud who's maladjusted, what are you doing? At best, if you're lucky, he'll do nothing with the Torah you're teaching him. At best, he's not going to be able to put it in practice. So the best you can hope for is at least that he doesn't put it into practice. Because the worst that can happen is that he tries to put it into practice. And then he makes a total mess of it. And he looks like an idiot, and he acts like an idiot, and it doesn't do anybody any good whatever. It doesn't raise the world. He's not able to bridge that gap between the ideals of the Torah he's learnt and the inadequacies of the world in which he operates. He's just not able to adapt to that. So he's maladjusted. And today they call it, in an extreme clinical case, schizophrenic, where you have your one little world in which you're living, which has got nothing to do with the other world in which you're living. You can't put the two together. Your one is a world of fantasies and ideals, and your other is a world which is a world of practicality, and you can't fit the two together. That's when it becomes clinically sick. But there's a tremendous range of people, A, who are not quite clinically schizophrenic, and B, they're people who are not at all clinically schizophrenic, but still spiritually schizophrenic. They have this world of ideals on which they learn. This is how it has to be, finished. And why isn't the world like that? Because the world is wicked. What a horrible world, and we've got to hate it. That world out there that doesn't keep to the principles of Torah which we've learnt. And anybody who doesn't keep to it is our Rosha, and it's wicked and black and awful out there. And we can't go there, and if we do, we've got to express this black cloud and tell them how awful it is. What does it do? What does it achieve? Love, harmony, Kiddush Hashem, Kedusha, misery, families break up, relationships break up, he becomes a laughing stock, Torah becomes a laughing stock. And who's responsible? The guy who put the power of Torah in the hands of this miserable wretch. That's the person who's really responsible. One has to be able to see before you start teaching. This man is not well adjusted enough to handle Torah. He's better off without it. Right, first teach him to become well adjusted, and then give him the Torah. as the Rambam says. That doesn't mean the Torah is for an elitist group. It's open to anybody. But you've got to be well adjusted first. It's not the Torah will fix all ills. There's some ills which psychiatrists have to fix. And if one has one of those ills, then one better go to the psychiatrist before one starts learning Torah. And when one's straight, then one comes to learn Torah. And it doesn't have to be a psychiatrist. It can be a Rav, as the Rambam says, Machzirim. We bring him back to the straight and narrow path. Not the narrow, sorry, the straight path. And no, really, in Torah that word is never used. That's a creation of the Christians. And when one's brought him back and he's a normal, well-adjusted human being, then you can start teaching in Torah. That's fine. And what can be one step worse than the scenario that I've just painted? And that's that he uses Torah as an excuse as to why he can't adjust to the world. That's why. Because I'm a frum Jew. I can't adjust to that secular world out there. I would be disappointed in myself if I could. That's the next step that happens. And then you've created a complete misfit. And a man who uses Torah not a crutch, that would be alright if he used it as a crutch, but as an excuse for being inadequate, and that inadequacy does himself harm, and Torah harm, and the world harm, and one's created a monster of incredible proportions. And therefore it has to be Talmud Shehu Hogun. One has to teach a Talmud which is Hogun, and if he's not Hogun, it's Kazerek Evan Lamarkulis. And the Maharal takes this thought one step further. The Maharal says the following, and it's incredible that he saw it at his time already. He says, you know, what is Malkulis? There's no inherent value in the worship of a Malkulis. The idol means nothing and the action means nothing. But there's something you've got to admire about that Malkulis, says the Maharal. It's a fake. And you fake the world. You fooled the whole world. Because what happens? How does it become such a big mound? Somebody sees somebody throwing, so he throws. And somebody else comes, and then tourists walk past, and they say, what is this? And the guide says, it's a form of idolatry. You're supposed to throw a stone on, and it's good luck if you do. And they think, well, good luck can't do any harm, and they throw. And before very long, you've got the whole world going past throwing stones on this thing. And the creator of the Malkulis is laughing. That's what the Malkulis is. It's a way of showing the world what idiotic sheep they are. Doing absolutely things that are absolutely meaningless simply because everybody else has done it. And ultimately there's a huge mountain of stones, and it's a very impressive looking thing, and then automatically one's almost drawn to adding stones onto it, or kicking a stone on, throwing a stone on, whatever it is. And that's Avodah Zarah. That's proper idolatry to do such a thing. To a Malkulis, to something which is created for the purpose of Malkulis. It doesn't represent a deity. It doesn't represent anything spiritual, whatever. It's simply you've been taken in with the rest of the people. Says the Maharal, that's what the Gemara means. If you teach Torah to somebody like this that we've just described, to a maladjusted human being who's going to use the Torah as an excuse for not adjusting, and it's going to aggravate his not adjusting, you know what the next step is, says the Maharal? People will start saying, that's Torah. It's meant to be like that. Not being able to adjust to the wicked world outside is a sign that you're really involved in Torah, says the Maharal. And you'll have the whole world being fooled. And they'll start seeing detachment and maladjustment as a virtue of Torah, as one of the greatnesses of Torah. This is it. It's meant to be that way. And that's the fake. And that's the fooling around, which is exactly the same as throwing a stone at a Malkulis. It's meaningless. It's empty. It's not real. It's not doing anything for the world. It's not making the world a better place. And people convince themselves that that's how it's supposed to be. We're meant to be involved in a kind of Torah which doesn't make the world a better place. If anything, it makes it blacker and more horrible. That's what it's supposed to be. That's the Evan Lamarkulis. And who's responsible, says the Maharal? Says the Gemara. The man who originally taught Torah to the wrong people. That's who's really responsible. And that's why it's a din in Shulchan Aruch that one has to be careful to whom one teaches the Torah. Let's come to Avraham Avinu now. We remember last year or the year before, I don't remember quite when it was, we analyzed the differences between Avraham and Lot's methods of education. And basically we said, Lot's principle was to go out among the people. Storm is the worst place that there is. Let me take the Torah that I learnt by Avraham, and let me go and set up house in Sodom, and let me influence Storm to come right. Avraham was also to spread Torah. But he opened his house with four doors. Anybody who wants comes here. I don't go out. I'm not going to subject myself to the forces of those societies and try and teach Torah there. It will never work. If you want to come and teach Torah, come to my house. And you can have as much Torah as you want. More than that we see now in the case of Avraham. By Yorot Likrosam, once he just sees you on the horizon, making towards his house,
And the Medrash says his house was specifically built just off the road, so that he could see quite a way down, whether you were planning just to walk down the road or you would actually turn towards his house. And there was nothing else on this path other than his house. So if he saw you turning off the main road, he knew that you had decided to approach him. At that point he would run out. Once you have decided to make the approach, once the individual has decided to make the approach, Avraham Avinu is prepared to respond and is prepared to run in all his old age and his sickness and his tiredness and fatigue. That doesn't matter. You've made the decision just to start coming. He'll run out of his house and he'll meet you with food and drink and please to come into his home. That's what Avraham Avinu will do. But he won't go out to Sodom before Sodom has shown any interest in coming to Avraham. That's the difference between Avraham and Lot. So Lot we can discard already. We see clearly in the Torah that Lot's method is not the correct way of working. We'll define it a little bit more clearly as we did that time in a few minutes. But let's understand Avraham a little bit better. Sometimes he'll run to meet people and sometimes he won't. That's what we're told in the Midrash. He had to study them to decide whether he'll run or not. If he just sees that they're Bnei Adam Gedolim, that they're great people, then he won't run. Then they can come. But if they're great people, he'll run. If they also, if they show kavod to one another, then he'll run. If these very different people can honor one another, then he's going to run. By most people, the phenomena of what they've come to call the Baal Tshuva movement is one of the most exciting things that's happened in the Torah world, not just over the last 5 years in which it's happened, but for very many years. There are people in the Torah world who share a different view. And I'm not going to analyze the validity of their view or the lack of validity of their view, because they've been Adam Gedolim, they're no ordinary people, and it's a strange view. But we're going to appreciate an aspect of it. It's a view which sounds very extreme when I first tell it to you. But when we understand it carefully, you'll see what they're worried about. They said, oh no, this is one of the biggest threats to Torah that has ever occurred, and we would be better off without it. Sounds a terrible thing to say. Torah has been suffering for so many years, particularly after the Second World War. The number of people learning Torah has dropped and dropped. It's beginning to build up in Eretz Israel again. All of a sudden, a phenomenal growth overnight. And they say we would be better off without it. This is one of the most grave threats that have ever been posed to the world of Torah. And they say it for two reasons. The first reason, they say, in attracting all these people, it becomes necessary to present Torah in a Western way. Right, you've got to take Torah and you're not really teaching them Torah. You don't go out into the marketplace and start learning Gemara with them. You tell them philosophies of Torah and ideas of Torah and thoughts of Torah, adulterated and mixed in a way which they can absorb and understand, and that's what attracts them to Torah. So these people say there's such a huge body of people now involved in this activity of attracting people to Torah, and there's so much energy going into turning Torah into something which can be understood by a Western secular mentality, that you have the danger of distorting Torah completely. Number two, what they are attracted by is not the genuine Torah, it's this distorted Torah. Number three, this I didn't hear from them, but I presume it's part of what they're worried about, and certainly something that emerges from this. The danger of distributing Torah wholesale without being careful to whom one's teaching. Today, anybody can get into a yeshiva. Today, anybody can get into a shiur. Anybody who wants to learn Torah will find not a place to learn Torah. There's hardly a place that won't take him. It's an open door policy at the moment. Avraham Avinu also had an open door policy. He had four doors to his house. But he had the Asherah, the tree standing, the Elon, the tree standing outside to test. Not everybody came in through any of those four doors. One had to go through some stringent tests before one went through the four doors. When Avraham Avinu goes by Yoritz, he runs to meet them. Why is he running? Because he wants to make them feel wanted. That's why there's no din that you've got to run out, particularly when you're sick and old, to meet visitors outside. There's a din that you have to see them off, but there's no din that you have to go running after them on their way to you. Avraham Avinu does it. Why? Because he wants them to feel wanted and comfortable and at home. He wants to teach them Torah. He wants to teach them about the Ribbono Shel Olam. He wants them to be impressed with what a Jew is. He wants them to feel that they can stay with him for a while and that he's not put out, on the contrary, that he enjoys having them. So when will he run after people? He'll run after those people that he wants to teach. Anoshim Gedolim, the other kind of people who might be very, very great people but aren't the Bnei Adam Hagunim, they don't qualify to learn Torah, they're welcome to come, but he doesn't make them feel all that at home. And he might not even take them inside. If he finds that they're really idolaters, he might not even take them inside his house altogether. He'll just sit outside in the garden with them. But the people he really wants to teach, he runs after. And here one sees a little bit of the problem of Torah today. To run after people who are not hagunim, to learn Torah, can create a terrible distraction. That means that one can have a tremendous proportion of people who are learning Torah, and they're not suitable to learn Torah. And we discussed the consequences of teaching somebody who's not suitable in terms of the definition of what suitable means. So you can have people who are not well adjusted. Not only you can have people who are not well adjusted. Unfortunately, people who are not well adjusted see Torah as something very attractive, because it does present them with a cloistered excuse not to have to run out into the world. It does give them the opportunity to justify their inadequacies to themselves. So you have a tremendous danger of Torah automatically attracting an unreasonable proportion of people who are inadequate. And one teaches these people Torah, and one gives them principles, and it feeds that inadequacy, and it feeds the complexes, and it makes them more and more problematic. And you find a new religion developing, something which is not the old Torah which we used to have, something new and foreign to us. And this is a tremendous danger that we face. Avraham Avinu watched these people carefully before he decided how to relate to them. What he was looking for was that they should honor one another. Why honoring one another exactly? Why didn't he just watch their general behavior to one another to see if it was balanced and normal? No, he watched for honoring. Because that's the most balanced way for two human beings to relate to one another. I'll give you an example on that. A friend of mine went to the South Pole for a year with the South African Research Mission. And we discussed it in very great detail before he went, and even in greater detail when he came back. And I asked him why he wanted to go, and he said, really for one reason only. He's not interested in seeing the South Pole, and he's not very interested in the research. I think he was the cook, in fact. It didn't have anything to do with the research. But what he was going for, basically, was to see what happens when you take 20 men and you put them a few thousand miles away in such a situation where they're stuck together for a year. You can have a heart attack out there and you can't get home. You can die out there and you'll be buried out there. You can be terribly sick out there, and that's it. The 20 of you have to look after one another. There's no outside help whatever. Nobody for virtually the full 12 months, nobody can possibly reach there. There's a very short period when they go and when they leave, which is a time that the transport can get to where they are. For the rest of the year, they're totally inaccessible. They can radio to their families once a month or whatever it is, and they can speak for a minute or whatever it is. Basically, these 20 people have to be self-sufficient. So after various discussions and going into various aspects of it, off he went. And he came back, and virtually the day after he came back, he came to me with the slides and with the whole story, and it took very, very many hours. And I was questioning one thing. As the time went on, did relationships deteriorate or become more intimate? What happened with these 20 men shoved on top of one another with no possibility of escape for 12 months? And he showed me slides which he'd specially taken for me, which showed the interpersonal relationships, how they looked at mealtime, how they looked on their social situations, how they worked together. He photographed them fighting with each other. He photographed them arguing with each other. He photographed them playing with each other. Everything. He photographed the human side of it as much as possible. And he had hundreds of slides. And what emerged was that there were certain cliques within the 20 who got on each other's nerves, and more hatred developed over the time, to the point where murder could have been performed, because it was that bad that they actually had to be held back from killing one another. And there were people among them who got on well, who became more and more intimate and were able to joke together and to relax together and to have a good time together. But the one thing there wasn't, no honoring of one another. And it struck me then that the kovod habrius, the ability to honor another human being, is the one and only way to preserve good relationships between people, no matter what's going on. Whether you have agreements or disagreements, whether you like one another or you don't like one another. Just the ability to say, he's a human being too. He's also got a heart. He's also got feelings. He's also able to be sad, to be happy. He also has a family, children, maybe grandchildren, parents, grandparents, wife. He's also not just a concept. He's a real human being. He's also a creation of the Ribbono Shel Olam. He's also made by God in God's image. If just for that, kovod, I'll show him on it. That's the most balanced way to relate to human beings. Anything other than that is fanaticism. To become completely lightheaded with one another is fanaticism. It's a form of outlet. It's not real relating. To become violent with one another is fanaticism. To become feribled with one another is fanaticism. If you want to see a balanced behavior, the first principle is kavod, the ability to show another person honor. Some of you will remember the story that my father told about his days in yeshiva when he was out here, that in tells he described the level of a first shiur boy. And a first shiur boy was somebody who knew probably two siddurim of Gemara well already, so he was more of a Talmid Chacham than most of the people one comes across today altogether. And the second shiur boy was just about finished shas, and the third shiur boy was finished shas. And he described the incredible stature of these people as human beings, as intellects, as men of spirit, as men of kedusha, the type of people they were, the refinement. And he described the level of the third year boy in shiur. He said he remembers so clearly, and you remember him saying this, that when the Rosh Yeshiva, can you imagine what a Rosh Yeshiva you had to have over such human beings? When the Rosh Yeshiva used to give his shiur, used to go along satisfactorily, when he saw that a boy from the third shiur was about, a boy, a young man, third shiur was probably 30 year old, was about to ask a question, he started trembling and shaking. Because a third year boy was a colleague already. A third year boy wasn't a Talmud. A third year boy was somebody with one question could demolish everything he was saying. And he would start trembling. And he used to explain how if you went into shiur and you wanted to ask something while you were learning chavrusa, you asked somebody from your own shiur. And if you were the best in your own shiur, you asked somebody from the shiur above you. But nobody would think of in first shiur of asking a question of troubling a boy in third shiur. Still, it's unnecessary. Because whatever answer you want, you can get either from somebody in your own shiur, or at worst, from somebody in the next shiur. But you don't have to worry somebody in the third shiur. He said, and what would happen? What did happen? When a new boy who just walked in and didn't know terribly much on those standards, by mistake, he didn't know who was who, and he had a question, shouting a rashi, and he asked the third boy, the third year boy. The father said the third year boy would stand up to answer him. Would never answer even that young man sitting down. It's called Rabriz. He's a first year, what does he know? He's just started, he's a newcomer, nothing of that. He's a man, he's a human being. He's created in the image of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Immediately you would walk up to your shtender, he would stand up, no matter who you were. That's the kind of level of kavod habrias, which was just taken for granted. That was standard, that wasn't anything special, that was just normal behavior in those times. And this is the kind of relationship between people which has to be the basis. The ability to show kavod one to another is the basis. Says Avraham Avinu to himself, a sailor, a traveler, and an Arab. What are they going to talk about? What have they got to do with one another? How are they going to relax together? What kind of entertainments are they going to go together? They're traveling together, the three of them. How are they going to relate? So the room, if they're balanced people, if they're well-adjusted people, they will realize the problem, and they will understand that there's only one way to relate, and that's with kavod. You relate to each man with deep honor because he's another man. No matter what else, the differences come afterwards. The basic principle is we're all human beings, therefore we all deserve and require honor. And that's the first thing. If I see that, says Avraham Avinu, I know they're b'nei Adam Hagunim. I know that they're well adjusted. If they're well adjusted, I'll run to them because I want them to learn Torah. I want every well adjusted human being in the world to learn Torah, says Avraham Avinu. I want every normal mensch, every normal human being in the world to learn Torah and to grow in Torah. All I don't want is people who can't handle it. All I don't want is people who are extreme, people who can't balance a thing up and see it in its correct perspective because they'll make a mess of it. If they're b'nei Adam Gedolim, that means they're great in their ideal sense. They've learned a lot, maybe. They keep a lot, but they can't practice it. They're b'nei Adam Gedolim, and the Ribbono Shel Olam has a lot of derech eretz for them, and is prepared to wait while Avraham deals with them, but not to teach them Torah. Who do you teach Torah to? Only to b'nei Adam Hagun, to human beings who are well adjusted and can apply that Torah positively and correctly. Then Vayodot Likrosom is prepared to run to meet them. I just want to say one thing in conclusion, which is something that I mentioned that time that we analyzed the differences between Avraham and Lot. And that is that there are different ways of bringing people to Yiddishkeit. That doesn't mean that one doesn't bring people to Yiddishkeit unless they're Hagunim. That not every Jew has to be brought to Yiddishkeit. whether he's Hogun or not, that comes afterwards. You can't say because he's Hogun, he's not Hogun, he's not a Jew. He's a Jew, he's a brother. If he's a brother, he's got to be brought to Yiddishkeit. But there are two things. There's mitzvahs and there's Torah. There's doing the mitzvahs and there's keeping Torah. And there's learning Torah. You know the pasuk that says, Ki ner mitzvah v'tzoyra oya. A mitzvah is like a candle, and Torah is like light. And there are many different discussions as to what that means. But the following is a possible pshat, and it fits in very correctly to what we've said here. When somebody is lost, there are two ways you can go looking for him. Either you assume that he's sitting somewhere and he's not going to find you, so you take a torch and you go out looking for him. Alternatively, you set up a beacon where you are, and you assume that he'll see the light and he'll come to you. Those are two ways of attracting somebody who's lost. Either you go looking for him, or he comes looking for you. The important thing to know is that if you go looking for him, you don't take a beacon. You take a torch that you can shine into little places to find him. A focused beam you've got to take if you're going searching. On the other hand, if you want him to come to you, then you don't use a little light, then you use a beacon. And that's to know the same thing. When people are lost, one can either go looking for them, or one can set up a beacon and they can come to one. And that was the first machlokes between Lot and Avram. Lot went looking, and Avram stayed at home and set up a beacon. But if you're staying at home, it's got to be a beacon, and a beacon is Torah. That's it. I'll teach Torah. As a result of the Torah that I teach, they'll see the beauty of it, they'll understand it, they'll integrate it, and they'll come to keep the mitzvahs as a result of that. If you want to go doing it the other way, if you want to go searching for people, that's also okay. But then you can't do it with Torah, you must do it with mitzvahs. Because the mitzvahs belong to everybody. Then you go to people and you say, shake a lulav and shake an esrog, and you say, keep Shabbos and keep kashrus and so on. Don't ask why, nothing. It's nice, it's fun, you're part of the Jewish people, and that's what you should be doing. Finished. That can't do any harm. So you sell the mitzvahs to people who need to buy them. But one must never go around trying to sell Torah. Please come to my shir, it's nice, you'll love it. Please start learning, it's good for you, you'll nice. Never. The only thing, that the only difficulty with the learning is to see that one gets the horse to the water. That's all. He's got to try it out. He's got to taste it. But once that's happened, no sinning. Either the Torah is good enough to attract people, or it's not good enough to attract people, or not suitable for those particular people, in which case, okay, it's off. But to take Torah and to go around selling it, that can never work, because you land up selling it to Bnei Adam She'enam Hagunim. If you're selling, you can't be selective. If you're selling, you sell to anybody who'll buy. If you're at home, you can be selective. You can say, rights of admission reserved. But you can't say rights of admission reserved when you're out in the street, because the street is open to everybody. And if you want to attract people to Yiddishkeit with Torah, then it's at home. And then only certain people come in. Anybody can come in if they're Hogun. But some people might have to go through a stage of being Hogun before you start teaching them Torah. A stage of becoming Hogun before you start teaching them Torah. This is something which one has to understand today, and something which one fully has to appreciate today. The difference between attracting people to Yiddishkeit with mitzvahs and attracting them with Torah. And the understanding of the responsibility that one takes upon oneself every time one conveys a Torah thought to others, to make sure that one's conveying it to people who understand it correctly, firstly, who are capable of understanding it correctly, B, that they have understood it correctly, and C, most important of all, that they're well-adjusted people, that they're people who can take that and apply it, people who can live by it, not people who use it to tie themselves up in a cocoon which makes them totally ineffective. And with that, spreading Torah to the right people, spreading Torah to people who are well-adjusted, and to people who can apply it properly, one will find very quickly that the whole level in which they operate starts rising. That the people they have relationships with, whether it's in their business or their studies or their family and social lives, it makes no difference. If they're people who are learning Torah and are well adjusted, they will be projecting that Torah out all the time, positively, attractively, in a way which is going to make people more attracted to Torah, more, give people more of a feeling of honor of Torah, they'll understand what it really is all about. And it won't be chas v'sholem like throwing stones to a markulis, where it's just meaningless and it doesn't achieve anything and nothing gets done except that you manage to fool the world. Not with real Torah. Real Torah, with a person who's well adjusted, everything he does is meaningful. Everything he does leads to things that are meaningful. And the consequence is a world which is a little bit closer each time to the ideals defined in the Torah.